Now these things, brothers, I have metaphorically applied to myself and Apollos for your benefit, so that through us you might learn not to think of men beyond what is written. As long as there was a need for statements as severe as these, he avoided revealing the truth and continued arguing as if he were the one being criticized, ensuring that the dignity of those being criticized would balance out his critics, leaving no opportunity for outbursts of anger at the accusations. But when the time came for a softer approach, then he revealed the truth, removed the disguise, and exposed those hidden behind the names of Paul and Apollos. This is why he said, "These things, brethren, I have figuratively applied to myself and Apollos." And just as when a sick child rejects food offered by doctors, their carers call upon the father or guardian, asking them to take the food from the doctor's hands and present it, so that out of respect for them, the child may accept it and calm down. In a similar way, Paul, intending to criticize them about certain individuals, some of whom he believed were wronged and others disproportionately honored, didn't directly address the individuals themselves, but presented his argument using his own name as well as that of Apollos, in the hopes that out of respect for them, they might accept his proposed solution. But once accepted, he quickly reveals on whose behalf he was speaking in this manner. This wasn't hypocrisy, but rather understanding and strategy. For if he had openly stated, "For you, the men whom you are judging are saints and deserving of all admiration," they might have reacted badly and recoiled. But now by saying, "But to me it's really insignificant that I should be judged by you," and again, "Who is Paul and who is Apollos?" he made his message easier to accept. This, if you notice, is the reason why he says here, "I have used myself as a metaphor for these things for your benefit, so that you may learn from us not to think beyond what is written." This suggests that if he had used their own examples in his argument, they may not have fully understood or accepted the necessary changes, being upset by what was said. However, out of respect for Paul, they took the correction well. But what does it mean not to be wise beyond what is written? It is written, "Why do you focus on the speck that is in your brother's eye, but do not take into account the log that is in your own eye? And do not judge, so that you won't be judged." Since we are interconnected, it does not suit us to rise up against each other. "For he who humbles himself will be exalted," he says, "and he who wishes to be the greatest, let him be the servant of all." These are the teachings that are written. Let none of you be arrogant towards one another. After sidelining the teachers, he reprimands the disciples, for it was they who made the former prideful. And furthermore, the leaders wouldn't silently accept that type of talk due to their desire for outward glory, since they were blinded by that obsession. While the disciples, who weren't reaping the benefits of this glory for themselves, but were securing it for others, could withstand the rebuke with more patience and had more power than the leaders to eliminate the ailment. It appears, then, that this too is a sign of being arrogant, to be inflated with pride on someone else's behalf, even if a person has no such sensation concerning his own matters. Just as someone who is conceited about another's wealth is so out of arrogance. The same applies to someone bragging about another's achievements, and he rightly calls it being puffed up. For when one specific member rises above the rest, it's nothing but inflammation and disease, since in no other way does one member become higher than another, except when a swelling occurs. And so, in the body of the church, too, whoever is inflamed and puffed up must be the diseased one, for he is swollen beyond the proportion of the rest. For this disproportion is what we mean by swelling. And so it happens in the body, when some false and bad humor gathers, instead of the usual nourishment. So too is arrogance born. Notions to which we have no right overwhelm us. And notice with what literal accuracy he says, "Don't be puffed up," for that which is puffed up has a certain tumor of spirit from being filled with corrupt humor. However, he says these things not to prevent all comfort, but such comfort that leads to harm. "Do you want to support this or that person? I do not forbid you. But do not do it at the expense of another. For teachers were not given to us so that we might oppose each other, but so that we might all be united. Just like a general is placed in charge of an army to unite those who are separate into one body. But if he is to disrupt the army, he acts more as an enemy than a general. Who makes you different? What do you have that you didn't receive?" From here, disregarding the people, He shifts his attention to the leaders. What he's saying amounts to this. From what can it be seen that you are worthy of praise? Have there been any judgments made? Any investigation undertaken? Any trial? Any rigorous tests? No, you can't claim any of this. And even if people give their approval, their ideas are not fair. But let's consider that you really are praiseworthy and possess the divine gift, and that the judgment of men is just. Even in this case, it wouldn't be correct to be conceited because you have nothing of your own. Everything you have is from God. So why pretend to own what you don't? You'll say, but you do have it, and others share it with you. Well then, you have it upon receiving it. Not just one thing or another, but everything you possess. These excellencies do not belong to you, but to the grace of God. Whether you mention faith, it came from His calling, or if it's the forgiveness of sins you're talking about, or spiritual gifts, or teaching, or miracles, you received all from there. Now what do you have, tell me, that you didn't receive but achieved by yourself? You have nothing to say. Fine, you received. Does that make you arrogant? No, rather it should make you humble. Because what was given is not yours. It belongs to the giver. So what if you received it? You received it from Him. And if you received from Him, it wasn't yours that you received. And if you just received what wasn't your own, why do you puff yourself up as if you had something of your own? That's why he also added, now if you received it, why do you boast as if you didn't receive it? Thus, as you can see, after effectively making his argument by acknowledging their perspective, he points out that they have their shortcomings, and quite a few of them, and says, firstly, even if you had received everything, it wouldn't be fitting to boast, for nothing belongs to you, but in reality there are many things you still lack. At the start, he merely hinted at this, stating, I couldn't address you as spiritual individuals, and I decided to acknowledge nothing among you except for Jesus Christ and His crucifixion. However, here he does so in a manner that embarrasses them, saying, verse 8, you are already filled, you are already rich. That is, you need nothing from now on. You have become perfect. You have reached the utmost peak. You believe yourselves to require no one, whether apostles or teachers. You're already filled, he rightly says, already, highlighting their unreasonable self-perception and the incredulity of their claims given the time frame. Therefore, he mockingly tells them, you've reached the end so swiftly, which was impossible given the timing. All more perfect things require a longer wait for fulfillment. Being full with a little indicates a weak soul, believing oneself rich from little, a sick and miserable one. For piety is never satisfied, and it shows an immature mind to think you've achieved everything from mere beginnings, and for men who aren't even at the start of something, to be arrogant as if they have grasped the end. Furthermore, by means of what comes next, he further embarrasses them, for after saying, already you are full, he added, you have become rich, you have reigned without us. Indeed, I wish to God you did reign, that we too might reign with you. The speech is full of severity, which is why he presents it last, after an abundance of criticism. For our advice is respected and more easily received when we use humiliating expressions after our accusations. For this is enough to restrain even an audacious individual and impacts them more sharply than a direct accusation, and corrects the bitterness and hardened feeling likely to arise from the charge levied. It's certain that this is the admirable quality of arguments that appeal to our sense of shame. They possess two contrasting benefits. On one hand, it cuts deeper than an open attack. On the other hand, it allows the person being reprimanded to bear those severe critiques with more complete patience. You have ruled without us. This statement holds significant power, pertaining to both the teachers and the students, and it underscores their self-ignorance and their profound disregard. What he essentially says is, in struggles indeed, he says, everything is shared between us and you, but in the awards and the honors, you are first. I'm not saying this out of irritation, which is why he also added, I truly wish that you did reign. Then, to prevent any perceived sarcasm, he appended, so that we might also reign with you. For, he insists, we would also obtain these blessings. Can you see how he simultaneously exhibits his strictness, his concern for them, and his selflessness? Can you perceive how he curbs their arrogance? For I believe that God has presented us, the apostles, last of all, like men condemned to death. There is a deep meaning and seriousness implied when he states, us. He wasn't satisfied with just this, but also emphasized his authority, striking a major blow, us, the apostles, those experiencing numerous difficulties, the ones spreading the word of godliness, the ones guiding you towards this strict way of life. He describes these last ones as being doomed to death, that is, as condemned, because he previously said that we also might reign with you, and softened his tone to not discourage them. He returns to it with more seriousness, stating, "For I believe that God has placed us, the apostles, last as those destined to die." He means, based on what I observe and from what you say, the most demeaned of all men, and explicitly the condemned, are we who are always facing suffering. But in your imagination, you already possess a kingdom, honors and great rewards. And in an attempt to highlight their reasoning as even more ludicrous and highly unbelievable, he doesn't just say, we are last, but God made us last. And he wasn't content with saying last, he also mentioned doomed to death, so that anyone lacking understanding would find the statement completely absurd, and his words to be those of someone frustrated and sharply criticizing them. Also note the wisdom of Paul. The same subjects which, when appropriate, he uses to elevate and display his honorable status and magnify himself, he now uses these to bring them down, declaring himself condemned. Such is the importance of doing everything at the right time. By doomed to death, here he is implying condemned and deserving of countless deaths. For we have become a spectacle to the world, to angels, and to men. What does it mean, we have become a spectacle to the world? We do not suffer these things in just one corner or a small part of the world, he says, but everywhere and in front of everyone. But what does it mean, to angels? It is possible to become a spectacle to men, but not so to angels, when the things done are ordinary. But our struggles are such that they are even worth the contemplation of angels. Notice how, from the way he minimizes himself, he still manages to show his greatness, and from the things they take pride in, how he illustrates their insignificance. For since being fools was considered more demeaning than appearing wise, being weak more so than being strong, and being disregarded more than being glorious and distinguished, and he is about to ascribe to them the first group of qualities, while he himself accepted the latter. He signifies that the last characteristics are better than the first. At least because of them he turned the attention not just of men, but also of the angels themselves to them. For our struggle is not only with human beings, but also with the spiritual powers. That's why it's likened to a tremendous theatrical performance. We are fools for the sake of Christ, but you are wise in Christ. He also spoke again in a way intended to humble them, implying that these opposing views simply cannot agree. Such differing things can't converge. How can it be, he asked, that you are considered wise and we are thought to be fools when it comes to matters of Christ? That is, one group is ridiculed, disrespected, and dishonored, seen as being of no value, while the others are honored and admired by many as a group of wise and sensible people. This prompted him to speak as he did, as if he was saying, how can it be that those who preach such messages are perceived as actively opposing them? We are weak, but you are strong. That is, we are harassed and persecuted, but you enjoy safety and are highly regarded. However, the nature of the gospel does not allow it. We are despised, but you are honorable. Here he positions himself against the noble and those who pride themselves on external advantages. Even now, at this very moment, we are hungry, thirsty, without clothing, treated harshly, and have no certain place to live, and we labor, working with our own hands. That is, I'm not talking about something from the past, but just what's happening right now, that we don't care about human affairs nor about any outward show, but we only turn our attention to God. It's something we too need to practice everywhere. For not only do angels observe us, but even more so the one who oversees all. Let's not then seek applauses from others. For doing this is to disrespect God, rushing past him as if his admiration isn't enough. We instead look for approval from our compatriots. Just like those who, competing in a small venue, seek a larger one because it seems insufficient for their performance, people do the same when, after performing for God, they look for accolades from people. By trading greater glory for lesser, they bring harsh punishment upon themselves. What but this has thrown everything into disarray? This creates worldwide confusion, as we do all things with an eye to pleasing humans. And even when it comes to our virtues, we don't value having God's admiration, but instead seek praise from our peers. On the other hand, we dismiss God's judgment when it comes to wrongdoing and fear the judgment of people. However, the very people we try to impress will stand alongside us in the final judgment, unable to help us. But God, the one we currently disregard, will pass the ultimate judgment on us. Even though we are aware of these things, we continue to be excessively concerned about people's opinions, which is the first of sins. Thus, when alone, no man would choose to commit fornication. But even if he is profoundly tormented by that affliction, his fear of people's judgment overcomes his passionate desires. But in the sight of God, people not only commit adultery and fornication, but many also have dared and still dare to do things that are even more horrifying. Isn't this alone enough reason to bring down countless thunderbolts from above? Did I mention adulteries and fornications? Indeed, we fear to do even far less scandalous things in front of people, but we lose this fear in God's sight. This is in fact the origin of all the evils in the world, because in truly bad circumstances we fear people, not God. For this reason, you see, we often shun things that are truly good, but not commonly viewed as such. We don't explore their true nature, but are swayed by the opinion of the masses. Similarly, for things perceived as evil, we act following this same mentality. Therefore, we chase certain things that aren't truly good yet appear attractive to many, treating them as if they are good, out of the same habit. Hence, we are led to ruin either way. Perhaps many may find this comment somewhat unclear. Therefore, we must articulate it more transparently. When we commit sin, we fear humans more than God. Hence, when we have subjugated ourselves to them and made them our rulers, there are also many other things which our rulers perceive to be evil, even though they're not. These, too, we avoid accordingly. For instance, to live in poverty, many consider disgraceful, and we avoid poverty not because it's disgraceful or because we're convinced, but because our rulers deem it disgraceful, and we fear them. Again, to be undistinguished and disregarded and devoid of any authority is regarded by many as a significant shame and debasement. We again avoid this, not condemning the issue itself, but due to the judgment of our rulers. On the flip side, we encounter the same issue. Wealth, pride, ostentation, and visibility are considered good, and we chase them too. Not because we inherently believe these things are good, but rather we are influenced by the beliefs of our mentors. The masses are our leaders, and the majority is defined by crowds, a harsh and oppressive ruler. There isn't even a need for them to command us. It's sufficient for us to simply know their desires, and without command, we comply due to the great favor we bear towards them. Yet despite God's constant warnings and admonitions, we fail to hear. The ordinary people, chaotic and comprised of all sorts, don't need a single command. It's enough for them to signal their approval, and we immediately obey in all aspects. But how, someone asks, can a person escape from these masters? By developing a mind stronger than theirs, by examining the nature of things, by disregiving the opinion of the majority, above all by training oneself in truly disgraceful things, not to fear people but the relentless eye. And again, in all good things, to seek the rewards which come from him. Thus we shall not even be able to tolerate them in other matters. For whoever, while doing right, deems them unworthy to recognize his good deeds and is satisfied with God's approval, he will not consider them in matters of the opposite sort. And how can this be, you might wonder? Look at what a man is and what God is. You leave one and seek refuge in the other, and you will soon understand completely. Man is subject to the same sin as you, the same condemnation and the same punishment. Man is like vanity and does not have sound judgment, needing correction from above. Man is dust and ashes, and if he gives praise, he often does it thoughtlessly out of favoritism or malice, and if he slanders and accuses, he often does it for the same wrong reasons. But God doesn't act like this. His verdicts are faultless and his judgment pure. That's why we must always seek his protection, and not just for these reasons, but also because he created and above all forgives and loves you more than you love yourself. Then why, ignoring such a remarkable approver, do we turn to man who is nothing, all rashness, all randomness? Does he call you wicked and polluted when you are not? If so, pity him even more and mourn because he is corrupt. Disregard his opinion because the eyes of his understanding are darkened. Even the apostles were unjustly criticized like this, and they simply laughed at their detractors. But does he call you good and kind? If you really are, then don't let his opinion inflate your ego, but if you're not, disregard it even more and regard it as mockery. Would you like to know the judgments of the majority of people? How corrupt, useless, and deserving of ridicule they are? Some of their views are driven by crazed and delirious minds, others merely from children's innocence. Listen to how it's been since the dawn. I will speak to you of judgments, not only from the common folk, but also from those esteemed as the most wise, from those who made laws from the earliest days. For who could be considered wiser in the eyes of the many than the individual deemed fit to create laws for cities and nations? Despite their wisdom, these people view adultery as something trivial, not meriting punishment. Indeed, no non-Christian laws consider it a crime or bring men to trial on account of it. And if anyone were to press legal charges for such actions, the majority would scoff and the judge would dismiss it. Gambling is also exempt from their punishments. No one among them ever faced a penalty for it. Binging and drunkenness, rather than being viewed as a crime, are seen by many as commendable. It even evolves into a competition at military feasts. Those who most need clear judgment and physical strength are those most enthralled by alcohol's grip, altogether weakening their bodies and clouding their minds. Yet not one of these lawmakers has penalized this behavior. Is there anything worse than this madness? Is then the good word of men so appealing to you? And don't you hide yourself in the earth? For even if all such admired you, shouldn't you feel ashamed and cover your face for being applauded by men with such corrupt judgment? Again, blasphemy by lawmakers in general is considered nothing terrible. At least no one has ever been brought to trial and punishment for blaspheming God. But if a man steals another's garment or cuts his purse, he's often severely beaten and even sentenced to death, while those who blaspheme God face no charges from the pagan lawmakers. And if a man seduces a female servant when he has a wife, it seems to matter little to the pagan laws or to people in general. Would you like to hear more about another type of foolishness? Because while they don't punish these things, there are others that they enforce by law. So what are these? They gather crowds to fill theaters, and there they introduce choirs of prostitutes and exploited children, yes, such that violate nature herself. And they position the entire public high up, hence they captivate their city. This is how they hail these great kings whom they constantly admire for their victories and triumphs. Yet what could possibly be more dull than this honor? What could be less enjoyable than this pleasure? From these are you seeking judges to praise your actions? And do you really want to enjoy the sounds of flattery in the company of dancers, effeminates, jesters, and prostitutes? Please answer me. How can these things be seen as anything other than evidence of extreme foolishness? I would like to ask them, isn't it horrifying to distort natural laws and promote illicit relations? They will certainly admit that it's horrifying. After all, they pretend to condemn such crimes. So why then do they glorify these mistreated souls on stage, not just bring them into the limelight, but even shower them with countless honors and unspeakable gifts? In other places, they punish those who dare commit such acts. But here, as if they were common benefactors of the city, they even spend money on them and maintain them at the public's expense. However, you might argue, they are infamous. So why teach them? Why choose the infamous to honor kings? And why destroy our cities? Or why spend so much on these individuals? If they're infamous, shouldn't they be expelled, which is fitting for the infamous? Why make them infamous? Is it to admire or condemn them? Obviously, it's condemnation. Are you then going to demean them by making them infamous, but act as if they were honorable by rushing to see them, admire, praise, and applaud? Why should I talk about the kind of fascination found in the horse races or in the wild animal fights? Those arenas are filled with senseless excitement, grooming the crowd to become merciless, brutal, and heartless, accustomed to seeing men ripped apart and blood flowing, with the wild animal's ferocity causing chaos. From the start, our so-called wise lawmakers introduced all these calamities, and our cities cheer and admire. However, if you wish, let's set aside these activities that are undeniably abhorrent, but didn't seem so to the pagan lawmakers. Let's look at their serious instructions, and you'll see that even these are tainted by public opinion. Marriage, for instance, is regarded as noble both by us and those outside our faith, and indeed it is noble. But when marriages are held, such silly things occur as you'll hear of shortly because the majority, enslaved and fooled by tradition, aren't even conscious of the ridiculousness but need others to enlighten them. Dancing, cymbals, flutes, indecent talk, songs, drunkenness, and revelries, all the devil's massive pile of trash, are then brought into play. I understand well that I may seem ridiculous in criticizing these things, and that I will be accused of great foolishness by most, as if I am disrupting the old laws. For as I mentioned before, custom has a powerful ability to deceive. However, I still will not stop repeating these things, for there really is a chance that although not all, some will accept our words and choose to be mocked alongside us, rather than laughing with them in a laughter which merits tears and overwhelming punishment and vengeance. How can it be anything other than highly condemnable that a young woman who has spent her life at home and been taught modesty from her early years is suddenly forced to dispense with all modesty and from the start of her marriage made familiar with recklessness, finding herself thrust among inappropriate and uncouth men and immoralities and femininity? What wrong will not be instilled in the bride from that day onward? Immodesty, arrogance, rudeness, the desire for empty show, as they will naturally want to have all their days such as these. That's why our women become extravagant and wasteful, why they lose their modesty, why countless evils arise. And don't tell me it's just tradition, because if it's a bad thing, it shouldn't be done even once. But if it's good, let it be done regularly. For instance, isn't committing fornication wrong? Are we then going to permit it to be done just once? Absolutely not. Why? Because even if it's done only once, it's still wrong. So likewise, if entertaining the bride in this manner is wrong, it should never be done. But if it's not wrong, let it consistently be done all the time. What then, says one, do you find fault with marriage? Tell me. Far from it. I'm not so senseless. But the things which are so unworthily attached to marriage, the painting of the face, the coloring of eyebrows, and all the other niceness of that kind, because from that day she will have many admirers even before her intended partner. But many will admire the woman for her beauty. And so what? Even if discreet, she will hardly escape negative suspicion. But if careless, she will be quickly caught up in it, having started that very day with loose behavior. Despite the great evils, the lack of these actions is considered an insult by some who are no better than animals. They are upset that woman is not on display for everyone, as if she were a spectacle on a stage. They should, in fact, see it as an insult when these things do occur, and as a mockery and farce. I know even now some people will accuse me of foolishness and make me a laughingstock, but I can tolerate the ridicule if it results in any benefit. Indeed, it would be fitting to mock me if, while encouraging others to disregard public opinion, I allowed myself to be affected by that sentiment. Consider then the consequences of all this. Not just in the daytime, but also in the evening, they deliberately expose drunken men, sodden and aroused by indulgent meals, to the beauty of the maiden's face, and not just inside the house, but even through the town center they parade her prominently, leading her with torches late at night so as to be seen by all. By their actions they encourage nothing less than her future dismissal of all modesty, and they don't stop there, they guide her with disgraceful words. This is law among the masses. Runaway slaves and exiled criminals, thousands of them with dangerous character, freely spew whatever they wish against her and against the man who is going to make her his wife. There is nothing sacred, just degradation and indecency. With such sights and sounds, what a great example of purity for the bride, wouldn't you agree? There is some demonic competition among these reprobates to out-insult each other with abrasive and indecent language, thereby embarrassing everyone present, and the ones who have managed to hurl the most insults and greatest indecencies at their fellow men are declared winners. Now I understand that I am seen as a disagreeable, moody person, as if I am taking away some of life's pleasures. This is the very reason for my sadness, that disagreeable things are considered a form of pleasure. For, I ask, how can it be anything but disagreeable to be insulted and spoken ill of, to be criticized by everyone, including your future spouse? If anyone in the public space speaks poorly of your wife, you react strongly and feel that life is unbearable. So how can it be that you disrespect yourself and your future partner in front of the entire city, and still you appear pleased and happy about the situation? Truly, this is a bizarre type of madness.
But, says one, the thing is customary. No, for this very reason we should most lament it, because the devil has entrenched the thing with tradition. Indeed, since marriage is a serious event, and that which propagates our species and the source of numerous blessings, that evil one, internally suffering and knowing that it was instituted as a shield against uncleanliness, introduces all sorts of uncleanliness into it by a new trick. In such gatherings, many virgins have even been corrupted, and if not so in every case, it is because the devil is satisfied for the time being with those words and those songs, so outrageous, with parading the bride publicly and leading the groom in celebration through the marketplace. Furthermore, since all of this occurs in the evening, so that not even the darkness can hide these evils, many torches are brought in, refusing to let the disgraceful scene remain hidden. For what purpose is the vast crowd, the large gathering, and the music? Quite clearly to make sure even those who are at home and deeply asleep are not unaware of these happenings, so that being awakened by the music and peeking out of their windows, they may bear witness to the spectacle as it is. What can be said about the songs themselves, packed as they are with all kinds of filth, introducing horrific love affairs, illicit relationships, household destruction, and endless tragic scenes? And they often mention terms like friend and lover, mistress and beloved. What's even more painful is that young women attend these activities, having abandoned all modesty. In honor of the bride, or rather I should say, to insult her, they jeopardize their own salvation. They act shamelessly in the company of rowdy young men with their inappropriate songs, their dirty language, their demonic harmony. So tell me, do you still question, where do adulteries come from? Where do fornications come from? Where do marriage violations come from? But they are not respectable or proper women, you might argue, who do these things. Yet why mock me for this objection, having been yourself conscious of this rule before I even spoke? I maintain, if the actions are justified, allow those well-bred women also to perform them. So what if these others are impoverished? Are they not also virgins? Shouldn't they also preserve their chastity? But now here is a virgin dancing in a public theatre filled with lecherous young men. And I ask, doesn't she seem to you more dishonored than a prostitute? But if you argue, female servants do these things, I don't absolve you of my accusation. Such things should never have been permitted even to them. For all these problems originate from the fact that we think so little of our household. It's enough insult to say, he is a slave, or they are maids. Yet every day we hear, in Christ Jesus there's neither slave nor free. Plus, even if it were a horse or a donkey, you wouldn't ignore it and would go to great lengths to avoid it being of an inferior kind. So how can you neglect your servants who have souls just like yours? And not just servants, but also sons and daughters. What should be the consequence? It's unavoidable that grief must surely set in when all these individuals are heading towards demise. And often, substantial losses occur, precious golden ornaments lost in the chaos of the crowd. Then, if a child is born after the marriage, we once again see the same foolishness and many rituals full of absurdity. For when the time comes to name the infant, instead of naming it after the saints as the ancients originally did, they light lamps and name them, giving the child the name of the lamp that burns the longest, interpreting this as a sign that he will have a long life. Yet, if the child dies prematurely, and there are many instances, there will be great laughter from the devil, who's been making a mockery of them as if they were naive children. What can we say about the amulets and the bells that are hung on the hand, and the red yarn, and other things full of such extreme folly? They should vest the child only in the protection of the cross. But they ignore what has converted the whole world, dealt a severe blow to the devil, and overturned his entire power. Instead, they entrust the child's safety to the thread, the yarn, and the other amulets of that kind. May I raise another issue even more absurd than this? Let no one accuse us of speaking out of turn if our argument uses this example as well. For someone who aims to cleanse an ulcer does not hesitate to first dirty their hands. Now, what is this extremely ridiculous custom? It's deemed as insignificant, but it's the beginning of extreme foolishness and nonsense. The women in the bath, nurses, and awaiting maids pick up mud and, using their fingers, mark a cross on the child's forehead. If one asks, what does this mud and clay represent? The response is, it wards off the evil eye, witchcraft, and jealousy. Surprising! What potency in the mud, what might in the clay, what incredible power does it possess? It deflects all forms of devilry. Tell me, can you help but express embarrassment? Will you ever grasp the devil's traps? How from early life he gradually introduces the various evils he has crafted? For if the mud has this effect, why don't you also apply the same to your own forehead when you are a grown man and your character is developed and you are more likely than the child to have those who are envious of you? Why don't you also smudge over your whole body with mud? I mean, if it has such a great effect when applied on the forehead, why not anoint your entire body with mud? All these antics are a source of amusement and theatricals for Satan, not only mockery, but also an impending doom of hellfire that these deluded ones are walking toward. It's not surprising such actions are prevalent among the Greeks, but it's particularly lamentable when found among worshippers of the cross, participants in unspeakable mysteries, and advocates of high morality. God has graced you with spiritual anointing. Why would you dirty your child with mud? God has honored you. Why dishonor yourself? Instead of denoting your child's forehead with the cross, which provides unbeatable protection, why forsake this and let yourself be consumed in Satan's insanity? If anyone considers these matters as trivial, let them realize that these are causes of serious problems. Even Paul did not deem it appropriate to overlook minor issues. For example, what could be less significant than a man covering his head? But notice how important this is to Paul and how vehemently he prohibits it, stating, among other things, he dishonors his head. Now, if a person who covers himself dishonors his head, how is smearing a child with mud any less than making it detestable? How, I wonder, can you bring it to the priest's hands? How can you expect the priest to put the seal on that forehead where you have been smearing mud? No, my brethren, don't do these things. Instead, surround them with spiritual armor from an early age and teach them to seal their forehead with their hand. And before they are capable of doing this themselves, imprint the cross on them. Why should someone mention the other demonic practices involved in labor pains and childbirths, which the midwives bring upon themselves with harm? Of the screams that occur at each person's death and when they are taken to their burial, the senseless mourning, the foolishness performed at the funerals, the enthusiasm about people's memorials, the persistent and absurd crowd of mourning women, the rituals of days, the days, I mean, of entering the world and leaving it. Are these really, I urge you, the individuals whose approval you are chasing? What can it be if not the height of foolishness to fervently seek the recognition from people who are so twisted in their perceptions, people whose behavior is completely arbitrary? When we should always turn to the always vigilant eye and consider his judgment in all that we do and say, for these people, even if they approve, will have no ability to benefit us. But he, if he approves of our actions, will both make us renowned here, and in the future day will share with us unspeakable blessings, which may we all receive through the grace and love of our Lord Jesus Christ, with whom to the Father and the Holy Spirit be glory, power, honor, now and always, and unto eternal ages. Amen.